From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Some days lately, it can feel like the seven horsemen of the apocalypse are upon us. Tsunami, bombings and war, famine and genocide in Africa, devastation in Biloxi and New Orleans, a mad exodus from Houston, frightening warnings of bird flu pandemic, and this week, even the mighty Himalayas rattled. It has been a year of crises so densely packed that it's not only dyed-in-the-wool end-of-worlders who are now, some days, unnerved. In this hour, we're going to look into the cauldron of disaster, politics, environmental strain, and media frenzy that raises the sensation of a world unraveling. We'll talk with a theologian, an earth science writer, a political observer, and you. Up next on Point, the apocalypse sensation and a diagnosis of the sense of unraveling. You can join the conversation. Do you feel it? The sense, some days, of a world coming undone. And what do you see at work here? The hand of God, global warming, media madness, life as cosmically usual? What's going on here? Here, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me today from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, is Bill Leonard. He is Dean of the Divinity School at Wake Forest University, where he is also Professor of Church History. He's author of Baptists in America. Bill Leonard, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Even in these times, good to have you, Jack. Maybe especially, Bill Leonard. We're going to talk in a few minutes with Charles Mann, science writer. We're going to hear from David Ignatius, a political analyst at the Washington Post. We wanted to start out right in the pulpit with you. You know the sense of unease that's out there. You know many pulpits, and certainly the internet, are just on fire with, I'm looking here, God is roaring to us in America. His mercy and his patience with us is nearing an end. We have one word, repent. That kind of the end is nigh vein is just thrumming out there in some parts of the Christian community. What do you see here?
Well, as a historian, the first thing I would say is stand in line with apocalyptic speculation. Mm-hmm. It's been going on since the beginnings of the Republic. The Election Day sermons preached in Boston during the colonial period would have had the same kind of emphasis to it. One of those sermons, very well known among scholars, New England pleaded with. Parallels this very much. So whenever particular kinds of global or regional crises arise, the millennial speculation can't be far behind.
Of course, almost all religions have that millennial streak in them. You know that very well as an historian. You say stand in line. We've been here before. And yet, for you, as a man of the cloth, a divinity school dean, when you look on the series of crises this year, does it turn your head? Do you find yourself wondering, what's going on here?
I think these become moments for exactly what you're doing today, when we step back and assess what is going on when these things happen. What kind of not only speculation, but conclusions might we draw about spiritual life, about the media, about politics and science. And I think it's important for us to take stock at these moments. And I think that's what the early preachers were doing in their own particular way. What does this say to us at these cathartic moments?
Does it leave you this stack up, this pileup of crises, turning to the Lord in prayer, or turning to think about the ballot box or the exhaust from your automobile, or all of the above?
All of the above. Also, I think for people of faith, whatever their particular faith tradition, as you mentioned, this is not uncommon, these kinds of questions, I think it does raise an important issue, and that is faith strong enough to bear with you, to get you through these inevitable crises? And so I think it becomes a test of everyone's faith, not just those who are saying, trying to give reasons for it.
Jack Beatty, a test of spiritual faith, also, it seems to me, at this point, a test of secular faith, faith in science and the traditions that have brought us to this point early in the 21st century, mighty in many ways and revealed as weak in many others in this year.
Yes, and paradoxical. You know, humankind has been helpless in the face of natural disaster since time immemorial. Now, unnatural disaster looms. A British government report predicts that irreversible climate change will set in by 2050 unless we ease our economic footprint on the planet. If we don't, the envelope holding life will be torn apart. You know, that footprint got heavy just yesterday. A chart of economic growth from the year 1000 to 1800 would show a flat line. Spurts of growth would be wiped out by the population growth they accelerated. Progress, in David Landis's phrase, didn't stick. Then, in 1800, with the Industrial Revolution, the line rises. Everything rises. Standards of living, incomes, lifespan, hope rises. Progress sticks. Karl Marx called this economic stirring man's metabolism with nature. Through burning up nature, we'd leave behind the kingdom of necessity and enter the kingdom of freedom. Only we won't. If we let the metabolism run on, nature will turn against us. Necessity, the flat line, will return. The anarchy of the market drives the metabolism, can't slow it down. Only politics, freedom acting on fate, can do that. Only collective choice, planning, leadership, responsibility can avert global warming. And yet, with ExxonMobil setting government policy, we're as helpless and hopeless in the face of this impending unnatural disaster as with natural disaster. You know, if only the generations who will inherit a blighted earth could make campaign contributions. This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a bribe.
Holy smokes. There's a manifesto in there. We're going to be teasing it out from many quarters in this hour. Bill Leonard, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation from Amherst, Massachusetts. Charles Mann is with us. He is author of the new book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. He covers science and technology for Science Magazine, The Atlantic Monthly, and Wired Magazine. Charles Mann, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
We've got the theological iron in the fire here. Science is part of this as well, and earth science. I mean, there was a lot of talk around the time of hurricanes Katrina and Rita about global warming and its potential to whip up fiercer hurricanes. Are we dealing with an angry god or just an earth out of kilter, earth science out of kilter here?
Well, it's important to recognize that the number of catastrophic events is actually not going up. We've had more storms recently, but had fewer floods. The number of floods that were in 2004 was, you know, catastrophic floods was worldwide was half of what it was in 2000. Mm. The number of storms has gone up, on the other hand. Similarly, the number of diseases and epidemics and that sort of stuff isn't going up. What's gone up is our vulnerability to them, and that's due to a whole complex of factors that all interact and play together. One of them, of course, is just the sheer number of people on the earth, which keeps rising. Another is urbanization. By 2030, something like two-thirds of the people in the world are going to live in cities, which are always much more densely packed and hence much more vulnerable. You also have more of those cities on coasts, which are also vulnerable for a variety of reasons. And then on top of that is this kind of unpredictable effects of climate change. But you notice that most of the things that you were talking about were on coasts, the tsunami, the hurricanes, that we experienced. And there you're dealing with impact of really that we've kind of screwed up coastal ecosystems around the world, and we're paying for it.
Most, but not all, on the coast. We're told that those birds flying overhead now or down in the chicken coops may hold a pandemic in their lungs. Of course, we see the Himalayas shaking in the last few days. Charles Mann, in your circle, in science circles, do you find people shaking their heads these days and asking themselves, you know, is there some unified theory of collapse here, or is it just media magnifying nature's regular tempo?
I think it's some of the most of the people that I talk to believe it's somewhat the media magnifying nature's usual tempo, but there is definitely an increased vulnerability. But that has less to do with nature than with us, than with our sheer numbers. That bird flu wouldn't make so much difference if it wasn't for the fact that the earth is so crowded that wherever that mutation occurs and that bird flu becomes transmissible between people, it will likely occur in some area where there's enough people to get an epidemic started.
Of course,
that wouldn't have been the case 100 years ago.
Of course, Bill Leonard, in the end, for humans, the way we look at the world, it really is all about us. I mean, if the way we're living is raising the tenor of catastrophe around human life, that feels like Armageddon.
Well, I think we've raised some very important points here, and that is if we think about what we mean by sin, if we think about these events as some preachers or public figures do about some sort of judgment, we often tend to run so quickly to the private. These are private sins of the cities that have become pits of corruption, but we often hesitate to look at the corporate sin in which we all participate simply by driving cars or by refusing to deal with the issues of how we deal with fuel. These have implications beyond just the personal kind of private sins that we often hear denounced in pulpits. So taking all of these issues seriously puts the issue often not on God, but on us.
And the call for sinners repent can go right to where the thermostat is set, right to the way we live. And maybe we'll hear in a moment to the political front as well. David Ignatius is standing by. Will join us after a short break here. This is it's an unusual conversation. It's not exactly science-based. It's not just religion-based, certainly. It's based in a sensation. You can feel it right across the American landscape. I wonder about abroad. This apocalyptic tinge in the air right now with tsunami, earthquake, hurricane, war, and flood. The sense of things coming undone. Bill Leonard is with us from Wake Forest University's Divinity School. Charles Mann is with us. His new book is 1491. Jack Beatty's here. David Ignatius coming up in a moment. You can join us. Do you feel it? Has it crossed your mind? Can it seem these days that the world is coming unraveled? Are you relating to Coleridge's imagination of disaster? Do you find yourself looking for a unified theory of what's going on here? And does that scare you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the apocalyptic tinge in the air right now with tsunami, earthquake, hurricane, war, and flood. The sense of things coming undone. You can join us. Does it, some days lately, seem like the apocalypse is gathering to you? And why? Is this train of events, fire, flood, quake, war, happenstance? Or are we contributing? Do you see global warming and human overreach behind the headlines? Do you see divine retribution or media hysteria? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined in this hour by Bill Leonard, Dean of the Divinity School at Wake Forest University. Charles Mann is with us. He covers science and technology for Science Magazine, The Atlantic Monthly, and Wired. His new book is 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. And right now, joining us from Washington is David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post. He writes about global politics and economics, former executive editor of the International Herald Tribune. David, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Lead us into the political piece of this conversation. Is there a politics factor at work in this sense of unraveling as you see it?
Well, I should say, first of all, that people in my world of journalism tend to resist the unified theories of anything. We're basically pretty cynical. On the day of the apocalypse, we'll be grabbing our reporters' notebooks.
And good for you. We're glad for that.
That said, I do think that there is a vulnerability in our society today to this sense of disaster and doom, and it comes from two causes that I see. One, on the political front, I do think this is a period of weak political leadership. We are looking at a president who, just 9 months into his second term, seems to really be losing traction. His approval ratings are plummeting. Mm-hmm. I think that leads to a sense of disorientation among the public. The idea that we would head for three more years of difficulty with a very weak White House would make everyone nervous. And secondly, in addition to weak leadership, we have unusually sharp political division. I think anybody who looks at our politics now senses that it's really poisonous, that the debates have become so personal, so ad hominem, so nasty, that it makes it very difficult to respond to problems in a good, creative way. We look back at good periods in American political history with a sense of envy, really, that we had leaders and we had a spirit of cooperation and compromise. The second aspect of our vulnerability, I think, relates to the globalized economy and the pace of communications. Mm-hmm. Events around the world just seem closer to us now. Disaster in the Himalayas, an earthquake in Pakistan, seems, because we see it immediately on television to be part of our life.
Right next
in
door.
In a way that disasters didn't used to be. And I think also the pace of communications pounds us with one event after another and leads to this sort of disoriented, almost enfeebled state in which we are becoming increasingly passive observers of these natural and political events. I think that's what worries me, the effect of the media in this sort of hyper-communications age on our ability to react to events.
But on the other hand, David, shouldn't the media be a kind of feedback mechanism for people to see what's happening in the planet? I mean, there's this, after all, is the point, to be informed, is it not? Or do you think it stacks up in a way that's so sometimes so frenzied that it short-circuits thinking rather than informing thinking?
I think that obviously we want to be informed that modern communications are a gift of modern life and the open flows of information are nothing we'd want to reject. But I do think we ought to look at the effect of this information-saturated world on our ability to respond. There was a whole debate that I'm sure your listeners or many of your listeners are aware of around a book called Bowling Alone, in which the question of why civic associations in America had fallen aside was examined. And at the end of the day, one part of it was that we were spending so much more time watching television, which made us afraid to go out, afraid of the traditional associations we'd had. I think there is a little bit of that going on, that the media is a blessing, but it also enfeebles us.
Sitting in our caves, afraid of all the images coming in, and yet there are real things going out there. Those were real hurricanes, real floods, real fires in Los Angeles. Finding the right balance is the trick here. David, yes?
I just want to say one more thing. I've been to Iraq often in the last 2.5 years since the invasion began. I'm always struck by how much more overwhelming and scary and apocalyptic the Iraq War seems as we observe it from the United States than it seems on the ground there. I mean, obviously, it's dangerous. You could get killed. But when you talk to soldiers, when you talk to Iraqis, they talk about it in a different way. And I think there is something interesting there, that these horrible events perceived from a distance oddly can seem even more horrible.
Of course, you and I know from long experience what a steady reality that is. The worst war scenes look all the worse when they're condensed into a report. When you're there, there are, of course, moments of peace. Maybe the media doesn't give us those moments. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. I want to get to them right away. Jerry's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Jerry. What do you think?
Hi. I want to pose the question, how does Matthew 24 play into this apocalyptic feeling, because it basically lays out everything that's going on right now?
Matthew 24, can you quote it for us, Jerry? What's that?
Actually, yeah, it is Matthew 24, 6-8. Yeah, sure, you can give me a second, I can quote it for you. It basically states, and you will hear of wars and threats of wars, but don't panic. These things must take place, but the end won't follow immediately. Nations will go to war against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in many parts of the world. But all this is only the first of the birth pains, with more to come.
The world end motif, a very, very ancient one. What do you take from that, Jerry? What question comes to your mind out of what you see and what you read?
Is it telling us this is where we're at and what should we do?
This is where we're at, meaning?
Meaning this is where we're at in this time and place, in this point in history. We have reached this summit, and is it not a wake-up call to say, let's get involved, let us be more involved in areas of Sudan, let's be more involved with, you know, more people that have been disenfranchised, oppressed, because time is running out.
Let us pick it up. And, Jerry, thanks for your call. Bill Leonard, is that the message? We're at the lip of the apocalypse here. Of course, here's Matthew from centuries and centuries ago. Is this always the clarion call, as you say?
Yes, time's always been running out. And you could take those verses and take them seriously in every era, so that we happen to know about many more earthquakes and famines, etc., than the biblical writers did, but they saw enough very close, in close proximity to their own region of the world, to have this sense that things were happening immediately to bring about the end of the age. So on one level, we always take these signs of the times seriously as to what we're to do in response. On another level, any era of human history can read these texts and find them extremely applicable.
And yet, Charles Mann, your science voice here, is there not something extraordinary about this moment? Human population, as far as we know, never been greater. Human exploitation of planetary resources, probably never been greater. I'm looking here at a Pentagon report commissioned not so long ago. And they're supposed to be pretty dry-eyed over there, painting this picture of worldwide catastrophic climate change starting in 2010. Jerry says, are there not warnings? Are there not scientific material warnings now of a different scale than would have been the case when regions saw themselves in trouble when scripture, ancient scripture, was written?
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. If you're talking about, you know, sort of percentages, clearly things were pretty bad in the 14th century when a third of the population of Europe died in relatively short order from the Black Death.
Yep.
We've seen nothing like that. And I don't think that even the predictions of the global pandemic of flu are predicting something like that. Similarly, in the 16th century, a fifth of the world's population died when enormous epidemics from European diseases swept through the Americas. So in that regard, we don't, you know, things are looking pretty good for us. However, if you're just talking about numbers, we have so many people here that it's quite likely that some of the things are going to happen are going to hit enormous numbers of people, just in sheer numbers, even though that's relatively small in percentages. So it's a kind of a glass half full, glass half empty, depends on how you look at it.
John is calling from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. My tendency is to agree with your scientific person, but I'd like to add some emphasis.
Okay.
I think the whole idea of the Armageddon aspect of this is extraordinarily dangerous. The real heart of the problem here is the general illiteracy of Americans and of the world in science, because it deprives people of the ability to analyze, be analytical about situations. When I'm an engineer and a scientist,
yes,
and when I first heard that there was global warming, to a scientist, immediately this is that there's something fundamental going on. You watch it for a little while, you realize it can become a runaway situation. We've known from the beginning we shouldn't be building in the wetlands and the coastal areas, because if you just look at the history of things, sooner or later all of that's going to get blown away. So we've been making mistakes all along. We mostly focus on our material well-being and not on just being intelligent people who need to learn about the world and what we're doing to it.
So, John, you're saying there's real danger out there, but if we look at it in terms of Armageddon, apocalypse, nihilism creeps in rather than a real analysis of what's going on.
Exactly, yes. And the fundamental conclusion is that we all ought to be taking a science course from one to the end of the of our schooling, so that we really learn some ability to understand this. I mean, this has happened to me because of 8 years at MIT.
You've got your science education. It gives you a way of looking in the world. You don't see enough of that. John, thanks for that call. Jack Beatty, how about it? John says, let's not get frozen by visions of apocalypse. It's sort of to the ramparts. We still have human agency here. Let's use our brains, understand what's going right and wrong, and put this planet on the best path possible.
Yes, and you know, one of the ways we make the future present is through statesmanship. That's what a statesman is. He doesn't deal with just now. He talks to now with reference to posterity. And just let me give you two examples of David Tocco, weak leadership. I'd call it craven leadership. Let me give you two examples. We've talked about Bush, but look at the Democrats. Al Gore, in 1992, wrote a book, Earth in the Balance, in which he said global warming should be the organizing paradigm of our civilization. Everything should come back to this. If he mentioned global warming in the 2000 campaign, well, I remember there was one question in a debate. Other than that, I'm not aware that he mentioned it. Why Michigan, West Virginia, taxes, mileage standards, all
industries that would be hurt by
there
that perspective, or think they would.
In 2004, John Kerry had an A- rated by the environmental groups in environmental policy. A-. Bill Clinton had a C. George Bush had an F. Did John Kerry make an issue of that? He did not. Why? Michigan, West Virginia. So again, these men could lead, could say to people, look, we've studied this stuff, and we understand. Here's what's going to happen. Here's what we need to do to prevent it. They didn't.
David Ignatius, Jack Beatty points at leaders or the lack of leadership, but of course they were appealing to constituencies. Does this come back around to every American voter, and say you weren't willing to vote for the right thing? Now here's your comeuppance.
Well, it's often said that we get the political leaders we deserve, and certainly there is an aspect of the American body politic that is calling forth the kind of pandering politicians that we have. That said, I think that in times of crises, if countries are lucky, and I don't know if ours will be, leaders can come forth who begin to speak a different language. You saw that, obviously, in the period of World War II, where Winston Churchill took a people who were flat on their back, mm-hmm. who didn't want war, who weren't ready for it, and by the quality of his leadership and his determination, changed England's fate. I think you can make the same argument about Franklin Roosevelt. And, I think that it would be surprising to me if in this period of crisis, as it moves forward, we didn't begin to get a better quality of leadership, in part because we have a more receptive public. People are saying, this really is serious. I'm going to stop the petty view of politics that I've had and begin to listen to other arguments. I do think that part of leading is calling for shared sacrifice to deal with problems. And I have a feeling for the first time really in some years that a president who made that argument about global warming issues and who said we're going to have to change, we're going to have to adapt our basic industries about the problems that are going to come out of Iraq. We think we have problems now, just wait 5 years. About the fiscal problems that are ahead for the United States, which we haven't talked about at all. Yeah. Talked about the need to work together and sacrifice. I think that would be a very popular line, and that is something that encourages me.
So there may be a silver lining in just how much we are being shaken up here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. David is calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This conversation reminds me of something I heard Kurt Vonnegut say very recently. He said, the Earth's immune system is trying to reject us. And I think that you don't have to be mathematically grounded in predator-prey relationships to understand that when populations increase to a certain size, they're vulnerable, and that's what's happening to the human populations, in which case the prey is microorganisms.
Vonnegut saying the Earth is trying to reject us, an immune system trying to shake us off. David, thanks very much for that. Bill Leonard, how does religion respond usefully to that kind of poetic but essentially scientific view of what's going on, I guess?
I think that's a great question. And again, this is the abiding apocalypticism that we must respond to. I'd kick up the discussion from Matthew 24 to Matthew 25 if we're going to use Bible, and that is where Jesus talks about feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting the imprisoned, whatever era you are in. And the people who wind up with the best judgment in the apocalypse in that story are the people who have done those things. And I think one of the lessons we've not said, and we need to mention here about religion's response and other responses, is what many of these floods, particularly in New Orleans, taught us, is how many people in this country, especially in cities, live on the edge of the infrastructure or underneath it, the people who live on the margins medically, economically. And what we have learned, what it was a genuine judgment against us, is the number of people who were terribly vulnerable because they live on the edges of the infrastructure of our society. And what are we going to do about that issue in our culture is another leadership question, but it's also a spiritual question as well, it seems to me.
Our caller John points to the same thing. I mean, you're saying religion can tilt either way, toward the apocalyptic or toward the socially engaged. John says, be careful, fear of Armageddon itself can paralyze society from a productive response.
Yes, and one of the other lessons that may be underneath here, and I'm very hopeful about this, is that churches that have supposed, if we can just elect leaders who have our particular ideological views, then we'll be safe. Part of what these storms may teach us is that faith has to be anchored elsewhere, that these things are going to happen, and this faith in leaders, faith in the king, that's an old prophetic response that warns against those kinds of things. You put your faith in God. You anchor your faith in something beyond the political, because every time you put your faith in the king or the politics, you'll get disappointed.
But live in the world and, we hope, survive. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the apocalyptic tinge in the air right now. With tsunami, earthquake, hurricane, war, and flood, the sense of things coming undone, you can join us. Do you see divine retribution, media hysteria, global warming? Is there a message in the tumult, or just sound and fury? Is the end nigh, or a new seriousness, a new dawn? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in this hour, and very happy to be so, by Bill Leonard, Dean of the Divinity School at Wake Forest University. Charles Mann covers science and technology for Science Magazine, The Atlantic Monthly, and Wired. His new book is 1491. You may have seen it. David Ignatius with The Washington Post is with us from Washington, D.C., and our own Jack Beattie is here. Lots of callers want to join us. Stone is calling from Westminster, Maryland. Hi, Stone. You're on the air.
Hi. I don't believe that these are apocalyptic times. I don't think that there are going to be apocalyptic times. But Americans tend to have the opinion or the belief that the world revolves around us. Tragedies have been taking place around the world for years, I mean, forever. And we've just come to wake up to the fact with the World Trade Center and Hurricane Katrina. Now that it's happening in our own backyard, we think that tragedies are you know, mounting.
So we don't look beyond our nose. It's just come to our doorstep a little more closely, and so now we say it's all going down.
Yeah, and I think that if any changes are taking place in the world, it's our own. It's of our own making. Evidence of this is today. Mm-hmm. The Bush administration loosened environmental rules under pressure from industry.
And watch out, but look at the whole world, and maybe it was ever thus. Stone, thanks for your call. David Ignatius, do you see a blinkered American upset here? I mean, the earthquake is in northern Pakistan also. Avian flu is elsewhere, but did 9/11 sort of crack us open to this scale of unnervement?
I think Stone has a really good point. September 11 was a destabilizing effect for America, for its political culture, for our whole way of thinking about the world and order in the world. And I think the shock waves from that event are still continuing, and they make us look at events around the world, I think, in a different way. There's a fragility to the world. I think Katrina reinforced that. Seeing those images was really quite shocking to people. The dean of the Washington Cathedral, Samuel Lloyd, made a marvelous comment recalling something Eric Severide had said, which is that civilization is only 7 meals away from anarchy. And I think when we looked at those images of Katrina, we thought that could be me if I was in that desperate situation.
But Stone says the world has always been having a rough ride, and it's just our long exemption that kept us thinking otherwise. Are we freaking out when the door is opened into our own peaceable kingdom?
He makes the really correct point that we are, you know, basically Ptolemaic in our conception. We think the world revolves around us. And we need to be Copernican. We need to see a world where everybody's spinning at their own speeds. That's just a fact about America. That's the way we are. And I think in our moment of vulnerability, we see these other cataclysms around the world as part of a larger story that has us at the center. Mm-hmm. And that's a mistake.
Charles, it's an interesting question. I wonder if you have a perspective. Is it just Americans with Katrina and Rita and the war that's on our hook so much in Iraq, with this sense of unraveling, or do you read it in papers, in headlines from around the world? Is this just our hysteria?
Well, to some extent it's ours, and to some extent it's I think it's a correct reaction. There's a difference between random events like hurricanes and earthquakes and attacks like 9/11. And the number of random events hasn't really changed, just their impact because of the mm-hmm. population explosion. Mm-hmm. The number of attacks, I believe, has gone up. David Ignatius will probably have the numbers better than I have, but I believe the number of terrorist attacks and incidents has skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. And so there is really a sense that these political events, which are, you know, much more impinging on us than they were, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. And in that respect, I think that Americans are quite right to be worried, if that's right.
Quite right. Ms. Rock is calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Ms. Rock, you're on the air.
Okay. And I'm a person who I believe I have a balanced information on science as well as religion. And
okay.
I belong to the Orthodox Christian. However, and I've been following Matthew 24, 25, and I've been ignoring, no, the world is not going to end this way. However, this is too much to ignore what is happening in 2005. And I'm thinking about the philosopher prediction, Astrodamus, which is very scary, and it's most of the thing what he says happened, and it's happening. And I wonder what your guests are thinking about that.
Nostradamus said it all, and of course people have read and gone into a swivet about that for centuries. Ms. Ruck, thanks for your call. Let's get another call side by side with you, if we may. From Burlington, Vermont, Jerry's calling. Jerry, what do you see?
Yeah, I have a lot of trouble. I have trouble with the last caller and some other people who have spoken bringing in this apocalyptic predicted sense of what's going on here, you know. Because I think what it does is petrify people, and it sort of says, well, there's nothing you can do. I mean, if God is going to intervene, it really makes me angry to hear this because it just gives everybody a free pass. I mean, somebody on your show was saying Bush's policies. I completely agree with it, but I don't think it's just Bush. I think there are a lot of politicians, U.S. politicians, who have given rise to this problem. And it kind of disgusts me. Rather than a simple example of this is the refusal to do anything about the dikes in the levees, rather, in
New Orleans. So
New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Something could have been done.
Pull your head out of Nostradamus, you're saying, and fix the dikes.
That's right. I mean, you know, it could have been done. And the last I heard, Bush was making his ninth or something trip to New Orleans. Well, who the hell cares about that? I mean, that's too late now.
We know Air Force One can fly there. Jerry, thanks for your call. Let's hear from another caller here from Mount Airy, Maryland. Cornelius is on the line. Hi, Cornelius.
Hello, Tom.
What do you think, my friend?
Well, I think that the first caller citing Matthew 24 was certainly on the right track. He stopped too soon. The whole idea is that the Lord Jesus, the Messiah, is coming back to take over all the kingdoms of men. That's the politicians, the religion, organized religions of every stripe.
Do you welcome that, Cornelius? Do you welcome that?
As a man of faith, of course I do.
Does that mean that we shouldn't build the levees stronger, that we shouldn't be worried about global warming?
By all means, man ought to go ahead and do those things that he sees needful to do for the betterment of the people. What is necessary is, on an individual basis, if he values the return of the Messiah, seeks to be one of those whom he chooses to participate in the kingdom of God, which he will establish in this earth, beginning at Israel, soon to spread over the entire earth, then on an individual basis, he needs to find out what he needs to do to put himself in place to and be participatory in that great and wonderful day.
We've got the second coming. Cornelius, we thank you for your call. We've got kind of the great American culture divide right on the air here. Let's keep going with it. Tom is calling from Boston. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
We're well.
Say hi to all your guests. This is how I see it. I'm from all over the United States. I've lived there and all places, and I really see that what's being made apparent to all of us is the global, you know, feeling of apocalypse. I mean, there is a feeling that exists now, but that's just because we're made more aware of it. What really is becoming prominent is that we are finding out our exact influence, and this is what is causing this paranoia to kind of go out of hand. You know, we're too far gone in the United States when it comes to fossil fuel. And now
we're feeling the human footprint on the planet, the heaviness of it today. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Exactly. And we're feeling that, you know, we can't do anything about an earthquake from preventing it. A storm is going to hit the coast. We can see it coming, but we can only get out of the way. What really is fueling the paranoia now is how far we've come as a civilization in using our resources and building our society, and now we're fearful that nature could have it crumble down.
And we're looking over our shoulder and saying, oh my gosh, what do we do about this? Of course, there are things that could be done. Tom, thanks very much for that call. And let's get one more here before we come back for some reaction from our guests. Laura is calling from Saltonstall, Iowa. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi. It's Marshalltown, Iowa.
Marshalltown, excuse me.
Yes. I do not feel like the end of the world is very close. I'm not sophisticated. I can't quote Bible verses or Nostradamus, that type of thing. But I just have a very basic feeling that if we don't change our priorities in our country, especially the United States, that we may not want to continue to live, even though the world won't end. I'm a healthcare provider, and I see greed being a big, big factor in how we treat the least of ourselves, and I just feel that we need to look at how we treat others and bringing in a Christian philosophy of treating the least of others like we would like to be treated, and also considering that if you are a Christian and you believe in Jesus coming again in the future, that someone off the street may be someone that you should be treating as well as you would treat your neighbor or your relative.
So you're saying a kind of caring may not only be good for the planet, but makes life worthwhile in your book, Laura.
Exactly. I just feel like our priorities are, I think the bottom line, greed is a lot of it, and greed in the
And you're speaking there from the hospital corridors and the healthcare world. Laura, thanks very much for your call. Jack Beatty, there's been quite a streak, the voices of America. What do you hear there?
Well, you know, she raises a very interesting question of priorities. And with New Orleans, everyone said, we're going to do something about poverty. And yet, a story in the New York Times the other day really described what is beginning to happen, not a war on poverty, but a war on the poor. And we're going to get into this next week, but just the way in which now the New Orleans situation, instead of shifting priorities, is actually going to lead to budget cuts that will impact the poor adversely. I mean, what could be more perverse?
David Ignatius, you've written recently, you said principles are a fine thing, but a narrow partisan definition of principle has led the Republicans to a dead end. Their inability to transcend their base and speak to the country as a whole is now painfully obvious. Like the Democrats in their years of decline, you write, they're screaming at each other. In these voices we're hearing today, David, do you hear a hunger for that new kind of leadership, or the same divide that's brought us to this pass?
I really do hear the hunger for leadership and the willingness to respond, desire to respond to all these difficulties in a creative way. I think that this is really a bad time for the political parties in Washington. The Republicans really are at a dead end. President Bush is so severely weakened now under attack from the right, just as his father was. I wish I could see strong alternative voices or new ideas on the Democratic side. I don't. What I do see is just this tremendous desire on the part of people really across the spectrum to do something more active to make a difference in the world. I mean, I see that with my own children and their friends. I see it every time I go to universities. I think we saw it in the reaction to Katrina, that people that called forth a real idealism that's in people, even an idealism among some members of the news media, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there is something out there beyond Washington, beyond these very brittle, stale parties that ought to give us some hope.
Charles Mann, on the science front, I've got to ask you just the foolish layman's question here. You've pointed repeatedly to the vulnerability created by larger populations, by living on coasts, by kind of living in harm's way. But I've heard even scientists in recent days shaking their heads and wondering if there isn't something else, if global warming could somehow be I don't know, getting the whole world rocking in a way that means pandemic, even quake. Is that absurd? Is it absurd to think about a kind of global pathology related to environmental damage?
Well, it's not absurd in the sense that we truly don't understand these very, very complicated systems. I mean, nobody really knows what the impact of climate change will be, and so you can't rule out the kind of huge change that that you're talking about. On the other hand, it does seem unlikely. What's puzzling to me, actually, when I listen to the public debate about this, mm-hmm. is that there are certain time-honored, very well-known, thoroughly understood ways to reduce our vulnerability that are done in places all over the world, and that our political system seems incapable of embracing.
What do you mean?
Well, for example, in Japan, where I've lived for a while, there's a, you know, it's the whole country is very prone to earthquakes, and there's a very orderly system for civil defense. You know, the kids go to mm-hmm. schools. They have, you know, each community knows the kind of disasters that it's most likely prone to, and people are trained in how to deal with them. And they get a very clear message all the way. When my kids went to school there, they got a very clear message all the way from kindergarten, which is that the government is going to come in as fast as it can, but, you know, there's going to be some time when before the government can get in, and at that point you're on your own, and this is what you have to do to maximize the chances of your own survival in case of a disaster. Mm. And in Tokyo, there's certain kinds of flood preparations and earthquake preparations. In Kobe, there's earthquake preparations. The other thing that is also demonstrated primarily in Europe and also parts of Asia is that there's an entire public health sector that's very, very important for preventing the spread of communicable diseases.
So be open to the big kind of systemic problem, but be ready to deal with what's actually here. Now, Bill Leonard, we've just got yes. 1 minute left. Let me ask you, Bill, if I may. You know the culture divide that's been famously explored in the United States and demonstrated in politics, the Christian right, very powerful in the last presidential election. Where do you see, this is too broad a question, we've just got a minute, I know, but where do you see the weight of that community going as we respond to what's happening in the world, toward the kind of rapture, Armageddon sensibility, or worldly solutions?
I think religious people have always tried to say God will have the last word, and I think that's what some of your callers have articulated today. On the other hand, they've almost always gotten into terrible difficulty when they try to speculate about actual events. And the Bible does both. Know that these things have spiritual significance for people who put on those kind of glasses, but don't spend so much time on them that you forget to care for the people who are most vulnerable in your own era. And I hope, whatever our point on the spectrum, these kinds of struggles in the culture can help us learn to do that together.
There's the word from Wake Forest Divinity School. Bill Leonard, Dean there, thank you very much for being with us in this fascinating hour. It's been great having you. Thanks for joining us. And David Ignatius of the Washington Post. David, it's wonderful to have you as always. Thanks a lot for jumping in with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Charles Mann, joining us from Amherst, Massachusetts, author of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Charles, wonderful to have you.
My pleasure.
And Jack, I wish you and all of us a long and happy life on this planet.
Thank you.
With our fingers crossed.
Yes. I'm 500 feet above a river.
500 feet, that's a good margin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.